Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Brian Ertz. He's board president of Wildlands Defense. He spent the last decade resisting this culture's depraved relationship with the natural world via grassroots organizing, national media initiatives, administrative and legislative policy advocacy, and support of a variety of litigation efforts aimed at preserving a wide variety of landscapes and wildlife species in the West. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start by talking about a campaign that's happening right now having to do with some prairie dogs in Colorado?
Sure. Well, in Castle Rock, Colorado, which is a community south of Denver, there's a piece of private land that Castle Rock Town Council is considering amending its planning ordinances to accommodate the proposed development of what has been deemed in media one of the nation's largest malls. And as it happens, that landscape is currently home to one of the more significant black-tailed prairie dog populations left on the Colorado Front Range. And so there's conflict there with respect to, obviously, if they are allowed to build the mall without accommodating some translocation of the prairie dogs, then one of the more significant populations of prairie dogs will be gassed and or buried alive prior to the bulldozers moving in to begin the development. And so today the town council is holding a hearing considering those planning level changes, and local activist Deanna Meyer is resisting those efforts and encouraging the community to postpone development of the mall until a biologically viable translocation effort can move the prairie dogs to safety.
So can you tell me, and tell listeners, I mean, you're a seasoned activist, and can you walk activists through? There's two directions I want to go. One is to talk about prairie dogs. Let's do that in a second. First, can you walk listeners through this campaign as a typical campaign? What does an activist do?
Sure. So typically, when I get called or others get called, there are different approaches to activism with respect to confronting or incentivizing responses that are compassionate and conducive to ameliorating tensions between wildlife and this culture's depraved relationship with wildlife. And so typically what I do, this is private ground, which is somewhat different than efforts on public land. Obviously, efforts on public land, there are more legal channels with which to pursue resistance and or delay and otherwise advance public input, including the input of environmental activists. And so on private ground, what we're dealing with is a whole different set of regulatory regimes, which are dictated more at the local and county levels, and then also the ability to engage with media pressure and really drive home what's happening to the prairie dogs, give the prairie dogs a voice within the local community and potentially the regional and national community, such as to facilitate a leverage against the developers' interest in their own vanity and in their own promotion of their economic interests as far as marketing is concerned. And so what we do is we bring to bear various media contacts who are sympathetic, hopefully, and, for example, Deanna has done a great job of local media garnering the attention of local media and regional media. And we really shine a light on the developer and the town council's responsibilities to accommodate the continued lives of the prairie dogs. And that pressure typically is quite compelling and effective oftentimes if you're able to bring it to bear. And so largely this private ground campaign has focused on media efforts and really working with the developers to communicate, look, do you want the press release to read, developer accommodated the needs of one of the most significant populations of prairie dogs left on the Colorado Range? Or do you want the press release to read, shoppers at New Mall are, frequenting a burial ground? And so you really just give them that option and try to work with them on their posture. And oftentimes, mall developers don't really care about the prairie dogs. And so you have to ramp up the efforts in that regard and really make as much noise as you can.
I've written a lot about abusive dynamics over the years, and a couple of different people who work on issues of battering and so on talk about how a lot of times perpetrators of that sort of violence, because they're gaining tangible benefits from their exploitation, they're oftentimes not amenable to discussions of good or discussions of what's right, because they're getting something out of it. It's like trying to talk a slave owner out of owning their slaves for moral reasons when they're making a lot of money at it. And one of the things that so many people have said to me does work, and I'm just saying this in sort of along the same lines as what you're saying, is that oftentimes perpetrators of these sorts of violence are oftentimes very sensitive to their image. And that's oftentimes one of the only... You can't get them through appealing to their conscience. What you can do is sometimes get them through appealing to their self-image, to their public image.
Absolutely. And I think direct confrontation is the best way of doing that. And really, I think you have to be able to demonstrate. Well, for example, working in the environmental community over the past decade, there's been, there are often different postures with respect to how environmentalists pursue advocacy. And some are more timid than others. And often half the work is really, from my end, or at least from my thinking and effort, is really instilling a sense of empowerment. Like you're saying, the analogy that you're using with the victim of abuse, the first step really is to empower the notion that it's not okay to be abused, which is often... abused, and in my personal experience with people that are abused, they don't see the problem, or they struggle with a clear indication of the problem. And so the first thing is really engendering a sense of empowerment, being okay with taking a firm stand and taking back our power with respect to advocacy on behalf of wildlife communities that are being abused. And so taking that power back and really engendering a notion that this is actually an important thing, it's a right thing, it's the right thing to do. And these prairie dogs or buffalo or wolves or salmon or bighorn sheep or sage grouse really are agents that are entitled to consideration with respect to these processes. And in fact, they're enfranchised in a number of ways as a matter of law and as a matter of public support. And so conveying that and really, confronting it with those who have an economic interest in the destruction and in the wanton and infliction of suffering can be a really powerful way of advancing advocacy and in creating a space for more favorable outcomes.
So let's back up and go a different direction for a minute. Let's talk about prairie dogs. Can you give I don't think most people probably know, most of the listeners probably don't know a lot about them. I mean, what we can say off the top is they've been reduced to about less than 2% of their range and 2% of their population. I also know that at one time, the largest prairie dog community in the world was about 25,000 square miles in Texas. That's one community. And that they're gone, of course, and they've been reduced almost everywhere. Why have they been reduced? Tell me about how, I mean, get people to fall in love with prairie dogs. I mean, tell us how cool they are. I grew up in eastern Colorado, by the way. I mean, on the eastern front, by the way. And we didn't have prairie dogs right where I lived, but there were prairie dogs within a couple miles. And I saw them all the time. They're cute as hell. And so tell me about prairie dogs and tell me about what has happened to them.
Sure. Well, for example, the black-tailed prairie dogs that are currently under siege right now from the mall once existed from Canada all the way into Mexico. And these populations, the communities of prairie dogs, were in, you know, the billions with a B. And the relationship that prairie dogs have to the prairie is essential, i.e. by, you know, the very character, and this is the case with many species, the very character of the very landscape itself is made so by the influence and by the inclusion of the prairie dogs in the community of life that exists on the prairie. Prairie dogs burrow, they exchange the soils in a way that enrich the soils, and the vegetation communities and the wildlife communities all are, you know, dependent on the health and well-being of prairie dog communities. And so the prairie is by definition a landscape that requires prairie dogs. Black-tailed prairie dogs and other prairie dogs are very wonderful in the way that they interact with each other. They're very charismatic and gregarious. They speak to each other using languages, and scientists have been able to describe specific dialects between different communities of prairie dogs. With their use of language, they hug and they kiss each other. They take care of each other. They express compassion and love. And one of the really unique things about prairie dogs is the way that they draw you in with that sympathy or even empathy, that you can relate and experience a compassion that is really familiar in a way that is really unique. And so in the early 1900s, prairie dog populations were exterminated largely to accommodate ranching, so the agricultural production of livestock on the Western landscape. And what they did was they poisoned prairie dogs en masse, killing billions of prairie dogs. As you mentioned, they currently inhabit less than 2% of their former range. And their populations are 1 to 2% of their former communities. And they're acute, so they're isolated from each other, which is a really, significant problem when you're talking about their landscape influence and their contribution to the character of the land, of the prairie. And so, largely, the ranching culture destroyed the prairie dogs under, uninformed notions of prairie dogs' influence on the landscape. They believed that the prairie dogs ate all the grass that they wanted for their cattle. And they believed that, prairie dog burrows are dangerous to livestock who step in the burrows, and livestock don't step in the burrows. It's just a lie. And so often these misperceptions, and I would argue outright hostility with respect to the livestock culture of death, have created conditions whereby widespread extermination of entire living communities results. And that's what happened with the prairie dog, as well as wolves and other, you know, bison and other wildlife that is perceived to compete with livestock. The government largely was captured by the livestock industry, or the government facilitated the extermination with government programs of poisoning and wholesale landscape scale eradication of prairie dogs to facilitate the domestication of the land itself to accommodate ranching.
My perception, I know this was the case about 10, 15 years ago, and I presume it hasn't changed, is that in some states like Kansas, it's actually against the law not to poison prairie dogs on your land.
Correct. In Colorado, there are counties right now that require, as a matter of ordinance, and there's actually going to be, hopefully there's some advocates that are wanting to challenge that, but that require private property owners to poison prairie dogs on the private property. I mean, government ordinances. And so this continued misperception and the continued hostility toward prairie dogs is a problem, and it's a depraved problem.
You know, that's the hatred of certain creatures. I'm thinking of prairie dogs, and I'm thinking of wolves. We could name a bunch of others too. It goes, for me, it's always been very clear that this goes far beyond simple economic. I mean, for one thing, like you said, cows don't, and we had cows when I was a kid. You know, I grew up around horses and cows in eastern Colorado, and you know, like I said, we didn't have prairie dogs right where I lived, but we actually had two pieces of land when I was a kid. We had the place where we lived, and then we had what we called the land, which was, I don't know, 30 acres. And, you know, my father was pretty wealthy when I was a kid. Anyway, we had about 30 acres that had some alfalfa land on it, and there were prairie dogs on that land, and we also ran cows on that land. And it was just like three or four cows. And the point is that no cows, no horses ever stepped in a prairie dog hole. I've never heard of anybody having a cow or a horse step in a prairie dog hole. It's a complete fabrication, like you said. Yet there's still, that was just this superficial excuse for an underlying hatred on the part of so many people toward prairie dogs, toward wolves, and toward, we hear this with the bison as well. And can you segue into another thing? I'd like to come back to prairie dogs in a while, but you have had the courage to step into one of the most overtly nature-hating processes that we normally see. Can you talk about the Derby?
Sure. So,
and people aren't going to know what this is, and people probably who are not in the West are going to be horrified. People in the West may go, yeah, I've seen this sort of thing. It's really horrible. Talk about the hatred of coyotes and wolves and directly your experience in the Derby.
Sure. So the hatred, I've been working on the wolf issue for a number of years and throwing reason at it, throwing science at it, throwing law at it, throwing every sterile notion, objective notion at it that we can. And as you say, it really isn't those economic self-interested arguments or any rational interest that drives the hatred for wolves and the policy against wolves. It's something else. It's a vitriolic something inside.
Well, wait, culture. Wait, there's like in Washington State, I don't know the rules in Idaho, but in Washington State, if a rancher is running cows on public land, by the way, at greatly subsidized prices, and if one of their cows is killed by a wolf, they are actually given, I believe, twice market value for the cow, which means from an economic perspective, they'd be much better off if the wolves killed all their cows than if they sold them to market. I mean, if, as a capitalist, I'd much rather get twice the going value, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. And that's what I mean by the economic self-interest have all been accommodated both by private conservation organizations or wolf advocacy organizations, as well as government programs. It's not an economic self-interest that's legitimate, though they put that out in the media. They hate wolves just the same. They want them sterilized from the landscape just the same. They employ government federal programs under Wildlife Services, which is an organization of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that poisons, traps, and aerially guns wolves away at the landscape scale. And so, with the delisting of wolves in Idaho, back to the Derby thing, with the delisting of wolves in Idaho, which they're still listed in Oregon, Washington, Utah, and elsewhere. But with the delisting in Idaho, what that opened up was an opportunity for a predator derby, which was a culmination of the vitriolic hate that has always existed for wolves into a public competition whereby hunters gather and kill as many wolves and coyotes as they can for cash prizes for the largest wolf killed, for the most wolves killed, the most coyotes killed. And then they publicly celebrate the slaughter by displaying these the dead wolves and coyotes in public and passing out the cash prizes, including to children. There are age categories for these things. And so this hasn't happened with wolves. It has happened with coyotes over the years in various places, but it hasn't happened with wolves for many, many decades as a result of their listing under the Endangered Species Act. And so with the delisting, that happened in a place called Salmon, Idaho. Just over a year ago was the first annual wolf and coyote derby that wherein anti-environmental interests were able to publicly celebrate the wanton destruction and meaningless infliction of suffering upon wolves and coyotes. And so this is really a vitriolic thing. It's really a cultural thing. It's a culture of death. It has no reason. They're compensated economically, as you mentioned, twice over often. They're already subsidized on public lands, and part of that reduced price and use of public lands is justified by, oh, well, the ranchers are going to have to sustain the economic encumbrance of dealing with predators. They've already got government programs gunning them down, wolves and coyotes and other predators en masse. And really, this is just an expression of hate and of depravity that existed and started up for wolves, at least in Idaho, again. And so a few of us infiltrated the first annual derby to expose it and publish the degree of the depravity. And then the next year, when it happened again, we went and directly confronted with cameras and with media the second annual Salmon Wolf Derby, Wolf and Coyote Derby.
Some people who, once again, if you live in the rural West, you've probably seen this, but some people in the East may not know about the crucified coyotes. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, in certain cases, and there are any number of anecdotes which are analogous to this, but essentially the ranchers, hate coyotes, hate agents of the wild that they feel threaten their their domestic production of livestock on federal public lands. And so they will wantonly slaughter the coyotes. And in cases, we've taken photographs and documented that they will crucify the coyotes on the fence posts, believing or at least maintaining that by crucifying them on the fences, it somehow deters the other coyotes from what they perceive to be their allotment. And so there are just absurd notions, and this culture does really horrible things to, you know, in just as a matter of their operation and their continued supremacy over the land, their continued influence on the land. So you'll see various things like beheaded coyotes and crucified coyotes on the fence posts to deter other coyotes from, you know, being on the landscape where their sheep or their cattle are.
You know, there's a story that I've told a few times. I heard several years ago that has always really struck me about wolves, which is that soon after the Europeans arrived on this continent, a bunch of the Indian nations in Northeast U.S., now United States, got together to have this big discussion as to that one of the things they couldn't understand is why the white people killed every wolf they saw. And they wanted to try to figure this out, and they spent several days discussing this, and really the only thing they could come up with is they're crazy. And, you know, I've written 22 books on this, and it's pretty much all I can come up with, too. It's the level of hatred is, I don't know whose term this is. It might be Foucault's. Excess repression or surplus repression. It's like when they're being evil, even beyond, and I don't think it's, I mean, anybody who knows my work knows that I don't think it's acceptable to build a mall on a prairie dog home. Don't think it's acceptable to build a mall anywhere. But then there's this level of hatred that goes beyond that you were just, this level of sadism that goes beyond that. It's like, I'm sure you and I have not talked about this, but you know about the Red Mist Society, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about that?
No, I wouldn't know enough to characterize it. Basically
it's like the wolf hunting derby, except it's for prairie dogs. That people will go out and kill prairie dogs for no reason at all, and it's called the Red Mist Society because if you shoot them with a high powered weapon, they explode into a cloud of red mist.
Right.
And just the fact that exists at all is dreadful. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, and the same exists for example, rabbits. So they will herd rabbits en masse, and this happens in southern Idaho, and it historically happened, where they herd the rabbits because they perceive the rabbits to compete for grass with their cattle. And so there would be so many jackrabbits on the landscape that they would herd them and then have public celebrations where they would bludgeon the rabbits en masse as they were herded. And there are all sorts of these anecdotes. And it's just really difficult. And as you were saying, it's insane. But when you're in a place like Idaho, and when you're in a place that's saturated with that mentality and that culture, it can be really, it's really difficult to confront, and often, you know, saturated in that madness, we question our own sanity, right? And so, there are just anecdote after anecdote of these depraved, violent, and evil relationships with the natural world. And it's almost, you know, there's an eco-feminist narrative in there for any number of wildlife whereby anything that has its own agency, has its own volition, is an agent of the wild, is perceived as a threat or enemy, and must be subdued. and must be domesticated or must conform to our expectations of, or not our, but their cultural expectations as far as their behavior. I mean, even the way that they describe problem wolves or misbehaving wolves, because the wolves will predate on sheep on the landscape, which is their role, which is their niche, which is how it's their contribution to the community of life to, to their influence is to move ungulates around, or one of their contributions is to move ungulates around and to cull the weak ungulates on the landscape. That's where the trophic cascade comes from, and where a limit on an ungulate's consumption of forage or consumption of grass comes from, such that any number of beautiful expressions of life can live in whatever harmony the landscape decides. And so, but the agents of the wild are punished for that. And it's perceived that they're doing wrong or misbehaving whenever even grasshoppers, they spray grasshoppers en masse with pesticides on public lands because the grasshoppers eat the grass.
Which reminds, go ahead.
And they do everything they can to maximize the agricultural production on a landscape the size of Texas and California combined with respect to public land, maximize the production of domestic livestock, the agricultural production of livestock. And they spray pesticides and herbicides to facilitate that production from crop dusters over our public lands. And they sterilize the landscape of predators, grizzly bears, eagles, wolves, coyotes, prairie dogs. They rabbits, as I mentioned. They do everything they can to wage war on the wild, the will of the land itself, and to bring it into conformance with a domestic production, a domestic agricultural production.
So, two things. One of them is that you mentioned grasshoppers, and that this reminds me of something that I just learned not very long ago, which is the largest by area mass of living beings in North America was not passenger pigeons, as I would have thought. There were more passenger pigeons, 6 times as many passenger pigeons as all other birds combined in North America. Those huge flocks of passenger pigeons. But the largest mass of beings was the Rocky Mountain locust, who would sometimes get in swarms as big as the size of Texas through the Great Plains. And they're extinct. And they went from swarms the size of Texas to extinct within like 30 or 40 years. They were exterminated around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. That actually was not, in this case, cows. That was, in this case, the plow. But the point is that you get something, a mass of beings the size of Texas is exterminated within 30 years. That's absolutely extraordinary. But then I want to go another direction, which is how did you become an activist, and what is it in you, and Wildlands Defense is you and your sister, right? And is it other people too?
Yeah, I mean, it's Deanna, it's whoever, it's a collective. Essentially, this is the way that I look at organizations.
Uh-huh.
The way that I look at organizations is we should use the organizations, not the other way around, right? And so the organizations should serve our activism, not the other way around. And this is unique, I found, within the organizational community at large. But what happened with Wildlands Defense is that my sister, Natalie, who has been, she's the executive director. And she's been in the Central Idaho backcountry tracking wolves, being with them, learning from them, listening to them for the past 6 or 7 years. And what happened was they learned of Echo, which was a wolf that made it to the North Rim of the Grand Canyon. this last year. And so she was called to as a guide or as a source that might be able to get a journalist from the National Geographic to experience Echo directly. And so when that happened, that really prompted our organization of Wildlands Defense. It took her roughly a day to find Echo on the North Rim and to howl with Echo with the journalist from National Geographic. And it was that howl, that inspiration, that really motivated our organization. And then, for example, activists in Colorado needed some consultation with respect to how to deal with a mall developer in Castle Rock. And so we pivoted there. And we've got a number of campaigns that are underway. But essentially what we do is support activists that are willing to do the work. And so we have, an organizational hat to do that, which has a number of benefits. But that's the history there. And, I came originally to activism at a young age. I Idaho is a wonderful place for wildlands and wildlife communities. And, I've always been inspired by my experience of self-willed landscapes and of wildlife and allowed to be what they are. And the experience of listening to that and appreciating that. And so that's really what motivated my involvement was my relative experience of madness in the city, right? And feeling a lack of ground. And then the reprieve from that I experienced in the wild and in listening. And I think that's a very, for me personally, that's a very motivating thing. And so I pursued advocacy with a number of organizations, and I've consulted with a number of organizations. And just learning more and more about how to engage and confront and hopefully, effectuate positive outcomes for the thing that I love, which is the land base and the community of life that inhabits it all around us.
So what do you think it is? I mean, all of my work is really about trying to activate people to act in defense of the places they love and to activate that love in the first place or help activate it. And so what is it about you and or your sister that has caused you to do this, whereas someone else goes and shoots coyotes? And how, in your experience, what are some of the triggers that might help people to get off their butts and actually do what Deanna is doing? I mean, that's the thing is if we had the numbers, we could shut down this whole party tomorrow, what is it that is causing you to do your work? And how can we activate that in others?
Well, for me, I think it's just a matter of proximity to the subject of our advocacy or the agents of our advocacy, the wild. I think the closer we get and the more intimately we experience and listen to the wildlife, the more radicalized we are. And obviously, I use the term radical in a positive way. And so one of the things is that, I think that's what ignites it. I think our experience and our proximity to the wild and wildlife ignites it. And I think that our willingness to really cut through a lot of the chatter that's disempowering when it comes to a lot of the contemporary channels of advocacy, if we can just say, you know, continue to hold true to that experience and to keep the focus on what's happening to the wild, and the best way of doing that is by being out there and by experiencing it and by thinking about it and by listening. And so, and by being unabashed in our conveyance of our conviction and our inspiration in that regard. And so, you know, in my experience, the best thing to do is really, like I said, it's so easy to point to so many reasons why, you know, we're, why those who care about the wild, in the West at least, are beat, or why it's impossible, or why it's going to be so much heave with so little influence. And just doing it anyway and beating your head against, you know, everything you can in every direction, and by being okay with the response, you know, the tired response that you get for such, is really an empowering thing. And I think we have the voice, those of us who are sympathetic and share these ideals and these notions and these experiences. We know what we need to do. We just need to not let all of the chatter on the outside stifle or otherwise encumber what we know we need to do. And so associating with people that really empower that notion and that uplift that notion and that support that, I think, is one of the ways that we can build a countervailing culture that really does confront and resist what's happening. And I know that's a difficult thing to do, and obviously I've got, you know, I've had any number of interpersonal dynamics or interorganizational expediencies or any number of all of these things, but really whenever it gets overly weight-bearing in that regard, I go on a hike, or I go visit a place that's quiet of all that and rejuvenate. And so I think those, you know, those associations with people that are likewise empowered and that proximity and that experience of nourishment that comes from being out there and observing wolves or howling with wolves. Have you ever howled with a wolf? It's one of the most incredible experiences. And it matters more than any of the chatter. It really ignites more certainty and resolve than any amount of expediency can diminish. So, I mean, that's what I would say. That's my experience.
So thank you for that. And what... We have probably 4 or 5 minutes left, and what I guess I have a couple questions. One of them is, what would you, if somebody is listening to this and they want to either assist you in your work or assist the prairie dogs, assist the wolves, I mean, what do you want here's the question, really. What do you want listeners of this interview to do?
Well, I'd like, you know, I would like, I think, very similar, I think we share a want to really activate a response, and I'm an all-of-the-above approach kind of person, and so if, you know, you want to communicate or otherwise create the network, you know, the network with respect to if you see something bad happening and you think that Wildlands Defense can help, reach out. If you, you know, if an individual thinks that other organizations are more in line or more likely to help their particular effort, then by all means. But ultimately, I would like to see the radicalization of the environmental movement, one that is empowered, one that has conviction and exemplifies conviction publicly and directly confronts the depravity of what's happening out there in an honest and unequivocal way. And whatever I can do, or whatever the organization can do, or whatever my sister can do, or whatever whoever I know can do to aid and support that response, wildlandsdefense.org. And otherwise engage and be activated. It works.
I got a note last night, and I get notes like this all the time, from somebody saying, gosh, I don't know what to do with my life. Can you tell me what to do? And I wrote to this person and said the same thing that I say to everybody who writes this to me, which is, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what your gifts are. I say it nicer than this, but basically, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what your gifts are, so I can't tell you how you should serve. I mean, people have said to me, Derek, stop writing books and start organizing because we need organizers. It's like, I'm such an introvert. I'm a terrible, terrible, terrible organizer. Plus, I'm incredibly disorganized. It's just an introverted, disorganized person does not make a good organizer. And on the other hand, I can do what I do. So I tell people, whatever it is you can do, and that's half of it. And the other half is, wherever you are, there is something under assault. And so I can't tell you what you should do, because you could live near the Rio Grande, in which case you should be working on Rio Grande issues. Or if you're working in Castle Rock, then you should be working on the Prairie Dog issue or whatever other issue. Because that's one of the great things about everything being so messed up, is no matter where you look, there's so much work to be done. And
Absolutely.
So there's no – sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I'd just like to, agree with what – everybody has different talents, and you would be surprised, because when I first engaged environmentalism, I thought that there was a certain way or a certain competency that I was supposed to have to really engage, and that's just not true. I mean, you'd be surprised how effective a school children, a classroom with school kids that send letters to the editor can be. You'd be surprised how effective any realm of contribution really is, in any number of ways that we couldn't really even anticipate until individuals who cared came forth and described what their talents are. And so, I mean, it's a big tent of opportunity with respect to how to engage, and just believing that and bringing whatever it is that you do, or whoever you are, whatever talent you have, is really important, because the biggest encumbrance to that contribution is people's own knowing better, or people's own idea or decision that, oh, what I have to contribute wouldn't matter. And so it's never articulated, and it's never brought forth.
I think that's a wonderful point. And the last thing, the thing I'd like to end on is, so if you could have, I think you've sort of said this already, but if you could have listeners to this interview take away one thing that they know in their heart, what would it be? It's like, I heard this great interview today. What was it about? And basically give them the soundbite you want them to walk away with.
Be true to that desire, that pull to resist what we see happening all around us, and voice it. I think if we just believed in ourselves and believed in our own voice and didn't tell ourselves that other people won't like it, or that there's something wrong in this, in our communities, that we'd be able to really effectuate a common voice, because I think that there are a lot of people out there that share this perspective or this experience, and they're isolated. And I think we're entering a moment where there's really a groundswell of its expression. And so I hope people will feel empowered.
Well, and that's, you know, and a great example of all this is what we started with Deanna. That Deanna learned about this mall going in and learned about what was going to happen in this prairie dog village, and she started this campaign because she saw something wrong. She's one person, started it all by herself, and she frankly turned to me and said, "What can I do?" I said, "I don't know. Why don't you talk to Brian?" And I hooked her up with you, and, you know, and then we go from there, and now we have a campaign. And so I guess the thing I'm trying to say with this, once again, I know we're very close to the end, but is to demystify a campaign is not some cosmic thing that suddenly happens. It's simply Deanna did her work. She ran into a brick wall, asked me what to do. I didn't know what to do, so I said, ask you. And then you have 15,000 ideas, and then that's how a campaign happens, right? That's it.
Absolutely. There's no, yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely, it's not out in the sky. It's not, it's just remarkable to me to see how everything falls into place with respect to what we can do when people are willing to just, you know, ask each other and start it. You know, Deanna has been a remarkable activist with regard to driving this campaign, and they're, any number of people that have really great ideas about how to help and that want to help, but are looking for that energy and that conviction. And it's like you say, it's just a matter of it's not this mystical thing that's beyond reach. It'll happen if you take it on.
Just have to do the work. It's, I guess one more thing. Sorry, I keep going on. But I love this line by my great-grandmother, which is, yard by yard, life's hard. Inch by inch, life's a cinch. And that's how I write books. I don't write a whole book. I write one page a day. I write one page and another page. And it's the same with this, that how do you stop this mall, or how do you protect these prairie dogs? Well, you do the first step, and then you do the second step, and then you do the third step. And then you run into a wall, and then you look around, and then you find the fourth step, and then you run into another wall. You do the fifth step. It's just, you do the work.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and speaking of which, thank you so much for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Brian Ertz. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.